Well, brethren, for this afternoon, we have two of our deacon brethren, Brother Aaron Keymichael and Brother Peter Caravas, to serve us. Two brethren that I love dearly, and I'm sure the same is true for all of us. And after we hear their symposiums this afternoon, I think we'll see that they also have a wonderful knowledge of the truth and an ability teach it and convey it. So we're looking forward to a blessing. First will be our brother Aaron Keymichael, and he will be serving us on the subject, the Festival of the Day of Atonement. The Festival of the Day of Atonement. Brother Aaron.
I don't know what to say after an introduction like that, except for that. The study we're going to take is based on a challenge or an opportunity Brother Carl gave to me. And so I did some studying on it, and this is a part of what I found. I just wanted to share it with you. We talk about the Day of Atonement. We're very familiar with chapters 8, 9, and 16. And that's what we're going to look at a little bit today. We're going to look a little bit at 8, 9, and 16. We're going to talk a little bit about the ceremony that is in chapter 16. And then we're going to ask a couple questions and see where we take it from there. But we specifically want to focus on the festival. How did the Israelites and how should we then celebrate or keep the Day of Atonement festival? So we start with Leviticus chapter 8. And we know that Leviticus chapter 8 delineates the consecration for the priesthood. And then in Leviticus chapter 9, we've got the consecration of the service of that priesthood. And then in chapter 16, we have the actual Day of Atonement itself. But Leviticus 8, the consecration of the priesthood, and Leviticus 9, the consecration of the service of the priesthood, had to precede what happens in Leviticus 16. Now, Leviticus 16, we have the procedure of the actual atonement for sin. And that was for the atonement of sin for the nation of Israel. And this Day of Atonement specifically stated as being on the 10th day of the 7th month, which, as you remember, is the month of Tishri. And for this service, the high priest would come into the tabernacle. Now, you can't see the chart, so I'll just have to talk you through it. The high priest would come into the tabernacle. He would wash and cleanse himself completely. He would take, and in doing so, he'd remove his garments of glory, wash and cleanse himself completely, and then he'd put on white sacrificial robes. And then he would go up to the door of the holy, and there are five animals tied there. There's a bullock, two goats, and two rams. He lays his hand, he takes the bullock, he slays the bullock, he captures the blood, takes the blood, takes two handfuls of incense and coals from the burnt altar, and he proceeds into the holy. Once in the holy, he offers the incense, and he takes the blood, he dips under the curtain and goes into the most holy, and he sprinkles the blood before and on the mercy seat. He comes back out to the holy, comes back out to the door of the holy, and then he does the same procedure with the Lord's goat, or with the goat. But first, he has to determine which one of the two goats is going to be the Lord's. So they make a determination. He takes the goat, does exactly the same procedure: slays the goat, captures the blood, takes incense and coals back into the holy, offers the incense there, goes under the curtain into the most holy, offers or sprinkles the blood, and he comes back out into the holy, and then back out outside of the holy itself. The high priest then takes the blood of the bullock, takes the blood of the goat, he mingles them, and then he sanctifies two additional items. He sanctifies the burnt altar and the holy itself. Then the high priest comes back to the second goat, the goat that's still remaining. He confesses the sins of the nation of Israel, and then he releases the goat into the wilderness by the hand of a fit man. Once the scapegoat is sent out, the high priest then changes his clothes. So he takes off his sacrificial garments. He washes and cleanses himself again, and he puts back on the high priest's glory garments. Then he takes the two rams that were still tied up, and he offers them. He slays them, and he offers them as a burnt offering. He puts them onto the burnt altar, and then he takes the fat and the internal organs from both the bullock and the goat, and he puts that onto it, and then it's offered as the burnt altar, as the burnt offering. And then the carcasses of the bullock and the goat are taken outside of the camp, and they're burned completely there. When all this has happened, and if the high priest has done everything up to this point correctly, the atonement for sin has been made. At which point in time, then the high priest can come outside of the tabernacle itself. And then we see that the sin offering, or the offering for sin, is now complete. So all those things have to happen and progress in that order. Now, we know that the sin offering was accepted because the high priest was able to leave the holy. He's also able to leave the tabernacle when it was all done outside of the court. If anything was done incorrectly in this process, he was liable for death. But the Israelites who were standing outside of the court condition, outside of the court, their view was blocked by the linen curtain, and they couldn't see what was happening inside. They didn't have any way of knowing how the progression of the Atonement Day sacrifice was going. Or did they? And the answer is, they did. But how did they know what was progressing? Well, remember when we said that the high priest, after he had slain the bullock and the goat, and then he offered the two rams? Well, before he offers the two rams, he slays the goat, he takes the blood into the holy and the most holy, comes back out, and then he confesses the sins on the nation of Israel. So the first indication that the atonement for sin was progressing was the Lord's goat, or the scapegoat, appears outside of the tabernacle by the hand of a fit man. So when the Israelites who are surrounding the tabernacle see that, they know, at least so far, the priest has been in and out twice of the most holy. The next indication that they have is where the smoke from the ascension of the burnt offering. Remember, there's two animals and parts of two animals on the burnt altar. And when that smoke starts to ascend, it's visible from outside, so now they know that at least the two rams have been offered. The third indication that they have is that of the progression of the sin offering is that the body of the bullock and the goat now appears and is taken outside to be burnt. So that's the third time they have an indication that the sin offering is progressing. And then the fourth and final one is where the high priest himself appears. And when the people see the high priest back outside the tabernacle, then they know that the sin offering has been complete. Well, there are three things that were accomplished with this Day of Atonement offering. One is that it raised the nation of Israel's consciousness of sin. Secondly, it actually made the atonement for sin itself. And thirdly, it turned the hearts and the nation of Israel back towards God. So we're going to look at each of those three things that it accomplished. Now, we know that the high priests were representatives of God. But how do we know that? Well, we can see that in a picture right inside the Leviticus 8, 9, and 16 Day of Atonement offerings. In Leviticus 8, the consecration was for the priesthood. In Leviticus 9, the consecration was for the service. The last thing that happened in Leviticus 9 was that the burnt altar offerings were consumed by fire. But who provided the fire? It's God. So in Leviticus 9, God provides the fire that consumes the altar, consumes the offerings on the altar. But when you turn to Leviticus chapter 16, and you look at the consummation of the burnt altar, or the burnt offering on the burnt altar, God does not provide the fire. Well, who does? It's the high priest and the priest. So in this, by this little simple illustration, God is showing that once the high priest and that service has been consecrated and accepted, they now become the representatives because they're the ones that burn the altar, burn the offerings on the altar. So we know right from Leviticus itself that the high priests were representatives of God. Remember, I said that one of the accomplishments of this Day of Atonement was to raise the consciousness of the nations of Israel's sin. Well, this Day of Atonement was a very solemn event, a holy convocation. And the nation of Israel was to have their sins atoned for. And even though the priests and the high priests were the representatives of God, they were still human, and they also were liable for sin. So one of the first things that happens in this Day of Atonement is that five things have to be atoned for. And if you turn to Leviticus 16:33, and I'm going to be reading from the New American Standard, and I'm going to start somewhere in the middle of it. Leviticus 16:33 says there's five things that are atoned for. You need to make atonement for the holy sanctuary, or the most holy. You make atonement for the holy, or the tent of meeting, and for the altar. So there we have three things already. The most holy, the holy, and the altar, the burnt altar. Additionally, you shall also make atonement for the priests and for all the people of the assembly. So we just said that the priests were representatives of God. Why did they need to be atoned for? It's because that sin is so pervasive and so defiling that everybody who comes into contact with sin is defiled by it. And if you were an Israelite indeed, you could not help but realize through this ceremony realize that even as the high priests themselves had to be sanctified from sin, and the tabernacle, the holy, the most holy, and the burnt altar had to be sanctified for sin, you could not help but realize how powerful or how corrupting sin was, and how if it affected them as the representatives of God, it surely must affect us. So that was how their consciousness was elevated and raised. The atonement for sin itself was to atone for the sins of the nation of Israel. But as soon as you start talking about the Day of Atonement, one question comes up, and that is, was the Day of Atonement for atoning for the sins of the nation of Israel for the past sins or for the future sins? And some brethren, some commentators will say it was for the past sins. Other brethren and other commentators will say, well, no, it's really for the sins that are yet future. So how can there be two perspectives? And is there one that's correct? We're going to take a little bit of a look at the Jewish year. The Jewish year followed a lunar cycle. Now, for those of you who may not know, lunar means moon. So what they would do is they would use the moon to divide up their calendar into 12 months. And they would set observers throughout the nation of Israel. And at the first glimpse of the new moon, which is a very small ellipse, they would herald it with the blowing of two silver trumpets. And you can read this in Numbers 10, verses 2 and 10. So once the trumpets are blown, the nation of Israel would realize that it's the new moon, and the new month has started. The Jewish year was also divided into two main seasons, winter and summer. And I've got a little chart here. So we've got the 12 divisions of the year. Now, for those of you who are more familiar with this, you realize that there really is one month that's missing in here because of the Jewish cycle actually had a 13th month. But for our discussion, we're just going to talk about the 12. And they divide the year into two seasons, winter and then in summer. And the first 6 months from the agricultural calendar was considered the winter, and the last 6 months was considered the summer. Now, winter started the rainy season. And so with the beginning of winter, then they would start their planting for the crops. And as you can see, Tishri marks the start right here. And this is the agricultural view of it. Now, Israel was an agricultural society, and that's why we're drawing it this way from an agricultural perspective. And in their society, they had three main occupations. They had the raising of crops, the tending of their sheep or flocks, goats, sheep, and then they had the cultivation of vineyards. And these three occupations figured prominently in their festivals and in their holidays. And they had seven main festivals throughout the year. And they had three of them in the month of Tishri, they had three of them in the month of Nisan, and they had one right here in the month of Sivan. So we have three in Tishri, three in Nisan, and one right here in Sivan. And if you notice, they're starting to line up with certain things. So there's three with the barley, one with the wheat, and one at the end of the year, or the beginning of the new cycle of the year for their agricultural aspect. Now, all those seven festivals were set on a moon, except for one, and that was the Day of Atonement. So when I say set on the moon, I mean that either the beginning of the moon, which was the little silver crescent, which started the month, or the full of the moon, which was the middle of the month. So six of the seven were set either the first of the month or the middle, approximately the 14th or 15th, except for the Day of Atonement. And that, as we already said, was on the 10th day. And I don't know why it was divided, separated and delineated, except perhaps that God wanted to make it very specific. So this is the agricultural, but they also had another calendar, and it's sometimes called the sacred calendar. Now you'll notice that it's offset by 6 months. So winter's in the top here, winter's in the bottom here. So Tishri is the seventh month, and the month of Nisan is actually the first month in the sacred calendar. And here are those three feasts. The Passover, unleavened, and first fruits all in the month of Nisan. Then we've got Pentecost, the month of Sivan. And then we've got the three feasts of trumpets, Day of Atonement, and the tabernacles in the seventh month. Now, why did God start his sacred calendar with the month of Nisan? And why not with Tishri? Well, I don't know for sure, but there's a couple of things that the scriptures tell us about the month of Nisan. One is that Nisan was the month of the Exodus, so it marked a beginning point for the nation of Israel. Nisan is also the month that the tabernacle was first raised and inaugurated in Leviticus 8 and chapters 9. It was in the month of Nisan. So it seems to be a good starting point for them. Now the sacred year followed the harvest cycle of the three main crops. And the three main crops were barley, wheat, and grapes. But the agricultural year followed the cycle of planting. First they would till, then they would sow, and then later on they would harvest those crops, barley, wheat, and then the fruit. And the reason I say fruit is because they also had figs, olives, and other things that they would harvest as well. But it was predominantly grapes at this time of the month. Whereas the sacred calendar followed the harvest first. And they followed the harvest of the barley, the wheat, and then the fruits. So again, they're offset by the 6 months. So the sacred calendar followed the harvest, the agricultural followed the natural cycle of planting, tilling, sowing, and then harvesting. So with that background, let's reconsider our question. Did the Day of Atonement, which occurs in the seventh month in the sacred calendar, or the first month in the agricultural calendar, was it for the sins past or for the sins future? If you look at it from the aspect of the agricultural calendar, Tishri, the month of the Day of Atonement, is the very first month. It would lead you to conclude that it was going to set the year for them to come. So by examining it from that perspective, you would say that the Day of Atonement was for the sins yet future, because it keeps them in relationship for the remaining months of the year. If you examine it from the aspect of the sacred year, you'd say, wait a minute, Tishri's in the seventh month. Here's where the tabernacle was raised. What happens in these intervening months? So from this perspective, you would conclude that the Day of Atonement was for the sins that were past. Well, which one's correct? I'm going to have to leave it up to you. I personally have I like the sacred view. And I think the scriptures support that view. And there are several reasons why. One is that Leviticus 8 and 9 tell us about the inauguration of the tabernacle. Exodus tells us it was in the first month. And then you've got several months that pass, and then you've got the Day of Atonement, where it's atoned for their sins. Well, what happens with all those months? Were the nation of Israel not serving God the first year it was set up? No, of course not. They were serving God. Well, what allowed them to have a relationship with Him? I think the answer is in Leviticus chapters 1 through 7. Those chapters deal with the offerings. You got the burnt, the meal, the peace, the sin and the trespass offering, those five offerings. And those offerings are what helped the Israelites maintain the relationship. So they, first of all, they kept the law. They agreed to keeping the law. The tabernacle was set up. And then those five offerings were set up for them to follow. And then the Day of Atonement came. The problem was that those five offerings were an indication of basically three things for the nation of Israel. One, it helped them to realize just how good God was, and also their appreciation for God. Secondly, as they made these offerings, they began to realize the cost of sin and what it would cost them personally. And it was also an appreciation of their love for God, because different offerings could have different elements. Several of the offerings, you could offer either a bullock, a goat, or turtle doves. And depending upon your financial position or your degree of devotion, you could offer one, the bullock, as compared to the turtle dove. The law just called for the turtle dove. But if you had a heart of love, you'd want to offer more. So those five offerings kept the nation of Israel in the relationship with God, so God could deal with them. However, not all the Israelites recognized their sin when they sinned, and not all the Israelites made the offering once they recognized their sin. So they fell from that favor. And so therefore God instituted on the 10th day of the 7th month the Day of Atonement. So they were in relationship. They had all these months to practice those sacrifices and to maintain that relationship, but they didn't. And so God sets them anew and gives them the Day of Atonement to help them have that relationship again. Now the third thing the Day of Atonement accomplishes is that it turns the heart of the people back towards God. Well, how would that be so? You know, even as the agricultural calendar marked the turning, you know, as the new harvest or the new tilling, new planting season, or here in the sacred calendar, no matter which perspective you look at it, the month of Tishri marks the turning point. Here they were in a relationship with God again. Here the new year starts over again. And Tishri was also the month where they had the final celebration of all the blessings of the Lord for the first 6 months. The harvest many times started in the month of six, but it concluded in the seventh month of Tishri. So they would have the Feast of Trumpets, the Atonement, and the Tabernacles there to summarize or wrap up their year of thanksgiving. So how did it direct their hearts? Well, it was a day of renewal for them, this Day of Atonement for the month of Tishri. So when the Israelites were watching the high priest, and they're watching the services go on, they didn't have any way, except for those four ways that we already mentioned, to know whether the sin offering was being conducted properly. So they had to wait and see how the progression happened. But there's another interesting thing that happens with the Day of Atonement. Now, all the festivals, all seven of them, required that it be a day of rest. All the festivals were a day of rest. But one of those seven was also a day of fasting. And it was the only one that was a day of fasting. And that was the Day of Atonement. So when you think of a festival, you normally think of celebration, merriment, and rejoicing. But not so with the Day of Atonement. Even though it was a festival, it was not a feasting festival. So how did that translate to the nation of Israel? Perhaps the best way is to liken it to the way we might keep the memorial. When we think about the memorial, you know, we're very thankful for a couple of things. We're thankful for the gift of God's Son. We're thankful for the relationship that we have as His sons. And we're thankful also for the blessings that God holds in store for all the world of mankind, salvation for all. And when we look at the gift of God, we realize that that gift came at a great price. So even though we rejoice, we're very somber or solemn in that rejoicing, because it cost God His Son's life. So God so loved His creation that He gave His only begotten Son. But His Son so loved His Father that He gave His life for His Father, and then also for us. So we begin to see how much the Israelites began to appreciate what they were seeing in this Day of Atonement. And as they started to look to towards the tabernacle, perhaps they would start reflecting upon their sins. And they would wonder or ask the question, will God be able to forgive me? Will God be able to forgive us, His people, for their sins? And as they would watch, and they would begin to see the different signs of the Day of Atonement services being conducted. First, the scapegoat comes out. So you know they're that far. Then the ascension of the smoke. Then the body is brought outside. And then last of all, the high priest himself comes out. And with the appearance of the high priest, then they would know for a fact that they indeed had their atonement made and their sins were forgiven. And so from this perspective, they could see how God's grace and mercy were magnified like no other day, because they were liable for death under the law, and they weren't able to keep all of the offerings with the pure intent of heart, and now God had forgiven them and set them with a new standard or a new relationship of righteousness for the remaining parts of the year.
Thank you, Brother Aaron, for those beautiful insights on the Day of Atonement. We wish it could have gone longer to have even further blessings, but we appreciate it very much.